I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Finding a trustworthy place to look after the little ones while you're at work is one thing, and being able to afford it is a whole nother battle. Today, a look at child care and child care regulation in Kansas. We'll find out how to verify that your provider is licensed, and I'll ask why folks without kids should care. Then we move on to a subject that, well, moves across interstates, highways, avenues, and everything in between. Being a trucker ain't easy. We'll learn about life on the road and the skills, slang, and danger that come with it. After that, Victor Wishna's latest installment of A Fan's Notes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Finding child care for young kids is problem enough these days. Throw in the challenge of finding somebody you trust and somebody whose license only increases the challenge. It's true that child care providers must be licensed by the state, and it's also true that state officials don't have a clue as to how many people provide daycare without licenses. At least we're talking about Kansas on that side of the state line. Today, a look at child care and how difficult it is to find care that is safe, reasonably priced, and dependable. With us today, Eldonna Chestnut has been employed by Johnson County's Department of Health and Environment as Division Director of Child Care Licensing since 2001. Eldonna, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Dean Olson is President and CEO of the Family Conservancy. That's a nonprofit agency dedicated to helping kids and families in the Kansas City area. Dean, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Bridget Schulte is the director of the Better Life Lab and the Good Life Initiative at New America. She wrote a major report on child care, looking at the cost, quality, and availability of child care in all 50 states. It can be found at newamerica.org, and she joins us now by Skype. Bridget, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Well, your kids, Bridget, are older now, but you remember what it was like looking for quality child care, I think. How harrowing was it? Because for my wife and I, it certainly was harrowing for us.
Well, I tell you, yeah, my kids are now 16 and 18, and I like to say that's when I started going gray, was when I tried to find child care for them. You know, both my husband and I were reporters when they were young. You know, we had really busy schedules, unpredictable schedules. We needed kind of crazy hours sometimes, and it was absolutely impossible to find. And at one point, probably one of the most stressful times in our lives, we actually had three different kind of childcare systems, if you will. We had a baby daughter, and there was no infant care in our neighborhood. And I had a long commute, and I didn't want to have to take a baby for, you know, all the way up to my office. Plus, I was out and about reporting, so I was never necessarily in the office. So we had a nanny share for her because I couldn't find infant care. Our son was in a childcare development center that only started taking kids when they were two. And then because I had that long commute, and so did my husband, and these unpredictable hours, we hired a third person to pick them up from childcare at the end of the day so they wouldn't be in there for so long. And I honestly don't know how we afforded it, and I don't know how we survived. It was really harrowing. And we have resources, and we have education, and if it was that hard for us, can you only imagine how hard it is for people who don't have those same resources and education.
Let's look more locally here. Eldonna, you do your work in Johnson County. What's your sense of the availability these days when it comes to quality child care?
Well, we have about over 1,000 providers just right here in Johnson County.
That sounds like a lot.
It does. And we know that, it's very interesting, the other guest mentioned the infant care. That's our biggest need in Johnson County as well. We've got lots of preschool openings. We have several opportunities for school-age children, summer camps during the summer. I think our biggest need also is for infant care. And then whether it be true or not, oftentimes I think folks have to start looking for infant care when they first find out they're pregnant to be able to get in a quality setting.
And infant care covers a child from what age?
Up to 12 months.
Up to 12 months, yeah. You know, Dean, you have maybe a broader perspective of the entire metro. What's your sense of the availability situation these days?
With quality care, there's basically not enough. you know, maybe 10% of the centers and family child care providers are high quality.
10%?
10, maybe 12%, depending.
And what are you basing that on?
Well, accreditation is one thing.
Mm-hmm. Or licensure?
Licensing is really the basement or the foundation. You know, it's dealing with basic health and safety. One problem we have in Missouri is a family child care provider can take care of four unrelated children without being licensed.
Hmm.
So that means without background checks, without any education requirements.
And Aldana, that's different than what it is in Kansas, right?
Correct. Yeah.
What is it in Kansas?
In Kansas, it's based on more of an hours, you know, two or more unrelated children greater than 20 hours a week of total care. So, and that's one of the challenges when folks move from Missouri to Kansas. They think, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. Where in Kansas, if they have two children, they're watching them 40 hours a week, they have to be licensed. So.
And Dean, what are your concerns about the Missouri side when it comes up to four unrelated kids? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you can have... you know, your cousin's kids, your children, your grandchildren, whatever, and not count them in that four.
Wow.
So you could have four unrelated children and five or six of loose relatives in your home and caring for them.
And pretty soon you've got like a whole menagerie of kids. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And many parents, if they take their children to any child care setting, they assume that they're all licensed.
Mm-hmm. Is it your sense, from the tone of your voice, is that too lax in Missouri?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to see it as?
Well, in Kansas, they had some looser licensing requirements until several children died in a two-year period, and then mm-hmm. they passed Lexie's Law that required all child care to be licensed.
Aldana, when did that happen? What year was it?
It was about 5 years ago. And just going to add on to that, we've always had the two or more greater than 20 hours a week. But Lexie's Law did tighten up a lot of our regulations, especially around supervision,
mm-hmm.
The requirements, the training, those kinds of things.
Why are things looser in Missouri, Dean? What's your sense of that?
They don't like regulations, and there's a lot of pushback, from four or five family child care providers can make quite a difference in Jefferson City.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lobby here, I assume. Mm-hmm. You put more regulations on, that might push some people out of business, and that wouldn't go over too well.
It could be, but, you know, what's a priority here? The safety of children or, protecting, someone's ability to they can still, as licensed child care providers, they can still see children and make money.
Bridget Schulte, again, you have more of a national perspective here, but when Dean Olson talks about quality child care, safe, dependable child care, running at about 10 or 12% in a state like Missouri, that strikes me as pretty scary.
Well, actually, it's pretty scary all across the country. We did this massive report, as you'd mentioned, where we really looked at the cost, quality, and availability of child care in all 50 states, really to ask the question, what kind of system do we have? We live at a time where there are about 12 million children under the age of five who need some kind of non-parental child care every day. We live at a time when the majority of children who are growing up live in families where all parents work, either single parent families or dual income families. So we're at a time where our family structure has changed enormously from that kind of 1950s breadwinner homemaker model that so many policymakers still think people live in and most of our policies really support. So we really wanted to look at, well, what's happening for all of those families who need this? And what we've found is that nationally, we have a very fragmented, patchwork, and broken system. Nationally, when you look at child care centers and in-home family centers, only 11% are accredited by national bodies, the National Association for the Education of the Young Child or other accredited bodies. And, you know, what the other guests are talking about is licensing is the floor. That's how you try to get the kids safe and you keep them from dying, right? To keep them safe.
Mm-hmm.
But But when you look at accrediting, that's just like that's one step up. You know, this is also a time where a child's brain is growing at, faster than at any other time in life.
Right.
And what the brain science is showing is that this is what sets the architecture for all future learning, all future behavior, and future success. So it's really to have that quality care at this early age is really critical. So we have a system that's way too expensive. Mm-hmm. Parents shoulder the bulk of the cost. They shoulder about 60% of the cost of childcare. It is wildly expensive for most families. What we found is that the average cost of care in the United States is about one-fifth of the average household median income.
Wow.
It's also more expensive than in-state college tuition, the average. That's also true in Kansas.
That's just amazing.
You know, if you look at infant care is even more expensive simply because it takes more people to do. You know, when you think about kindergarten, one teacher can take care of 30 kids. For infant care, one teacher can take care of about four, no more than six
infants. Dinos, when you talk about accreditation, what does that entail? That means an inspector actually coming into the home or the center and seeing if the place measures up?
Well, there's national accreditation, and you know, you can work on that for months to prepare. So they look at the credentials of the teacher. They look at the staff-child ratio. They look if they're using a curriculum and how they're implementing that. Of course, they look at health and safety standards.
You're talking about centers where there are lots of kids. Can you also have accreditation for in-home care?
Yes. Family Child Care has a national accreditation. And Missouri also has its own accreditation process for family child care and centers.
So you're suggesting here that when parents go out and try to place kids, they want to make sure the place not only is licensed, but that it's accredited as well. There's a second level here that you seem to be suggesting.
Yes, that would be great. And if the center is not accredited but they're licensed, they can ask some of those same questions. You know, how are your teachers trained? Do they receive continuing education? Do you use a curriculum?
Some basic questions like that. Eldonna, in Kansas, is there an accreditation process as well?
Well, I would say that we do have both the national and the accreditation for the homes and the centers. However, I would say I really believe in Johnson County our rate is higher than that 10%. Our accreditation rate might be that.
I was going to ask you,
But we have some great providers, both homes and centers, and the accreditation process is long, it's cumbersome, it's costly. So some folks, especially those who are just getting started, they can have a really good facility that is high in quality and not have actually gotten all the way through the accreditation process. I would say that parents need to look, certainly they have to be licensed. That's the first thing they should look for, to make sure they're a licensed provider. Second of all, they should be looking at their compliance history. In Kansas, they can go on the KDHE, Kansas Department of Health and Environment website, onto the child care licensing page, and there's a portal that parents can go onto and they can see what that provider's compliance history is. And really, at the flip side, because you can also have folks that might rate really high on their accreditation visit and be in trouble with childcare licensing. So it's not that gold star, that certificate doesn't mean everything. They need to look at that compliance history as well.
You know, it just strikes me here, Bridget Schulte, as we talk about this, that to some extent, this idea of placing a kid in a childcare center is something of a crapshoot. Even hearing our good guests here today talk about it, we're talking, there's some guesswork involved here. There's some gut-level feeling that's in play, and who knows how valid that is sometimes.
Well, and honestly, it really shouldn't be that way. And I think that, you know, when you look at how other countries handle the situation, you know, women and mothers have been in the workforce since the 1970s, and other countries have responded kind of in two ways. They look at those early years, that first year of life, as something that's really important for a family to be able to take care of that infant. And so many countries have paid family leave programs for both mothers and fathers. And some of them, on average, if you look at the Organization of States with Economic Cooperation and Development, about 35 developed countries, the average paid parental leave is 1 year. And it ranges from zero in the United States. We have no paid family leave system here, to 166 weeks in Estonia. So there's a wide variety. But most other countries have a paid family leave, sort of a national social insurance system, kind of like Social Security, where employers and employees contribute to a fund.
Right.
And then parents take care of the child that first year, or at least the first 6 to 9 months. And then they go into a child care system that actually has some help, like it has some subsidy from government organizations at the local, state, and national level. Businesses are more invested in it. Whereas here in the United States, again, parents shoulder the bulk of the cost of child care. The government pays some subsidies for very low-income kids. And businesses, what the research shows is that they typically pay between maybe 1 and 4% of the cost of child care, even though they're the ones that are really benefiting from parents working.
And Dean, this notion that this is something of a crapshoot, do you agree with that notion?
Not really.
Why?
Because parents can go to licensing in either state and look at the licensing record. So it's not as much of a crapshoot as you might think.
But that may tell you something, but it may not tell you the whole story, though, would it?
No. And what I would advocate for is that Missouri and Kansas develop systems for improving the quality of early education.
Mm-hmm.
They've had these before, and they've gone away, and they're both looking at something like a quality rating system, which most states have already developed. But Kansas and Missouri are way behind. So we need a system for improving the quality, as well as getting more information to parents.
Eldonna, you're nodding your head as Dean's speaking.
Right. I think there's a lot of resources that have been developed that we have put that effort out there to give parents the resources on here's the things you need to look at. In Johnson County, we offer a resource to new parents that here's what you should do. And I think one of the most important things is show up unannounced and show up at various times of the day, because the report is going to tell you what the surveyors have seen when they're in on their annual visits, which we're allowed one annual visit per year as far as requirement. And then we can be back on compliance checks, complaint visits, anything along that line.
Does that happen? Do you oftentimes show up more than once a year?
A lot of facilities that will. You mentioned quality earlier. If it's a really high-quality facility that follows all the regulations and does everything they're supposed to do, they may only see us once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Those that maybe have a little more challenges, have more violations, they're probably going to see us more than once.
If you show up once a year, is that unannounced?
It is. In Kansas, all of our visits are unannounced except for the initial visit when they're first getting their license. That's scheduled. Other than that, all of our visits are unannounced.
Yeah, Dean?
I was thinking about your crapshoot question.
Yeah.
Unlicensed care is a total crapshoot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have no idea that they have a smoke alarm. You have no idea if they have had safe sleep training. You have no idea if they know about supervising children. And that's when people get into trouble.
Eldonna, how do you even know in Kansas if someone, a daycare provider, is operating without a license? How do you find out?
A lot of times we appreciate the public helping us out, especially
They'll
parents.
They'll call you up.
Yeah, definitely. Especially parents when they go out and looking for daycare, and they just may find somebody on Craigslist or on internet or whatever, and they just go and interview them, and we tell them, make sure you're looking for a license because it should be on the wall, has to be posted. Look for these things and ask for their information. If they say they're not licensed, call us.
What's the penalty for someone operating without a license in Kansas?
In Kansas, it is a misdemeanor, and we have a great assistant district attorney assigned to child care licensing, so now we're really putting an effort forth because it's all about the kids. We want to protect our kids. So it's
against the law to operate without a license.
That's correct.
Same in Missouri, Dean?
Well, no. You can take care of 4 unrelated children, no license, no inspection. But
if you go more than that and you're unlicensed?
Yes, it's against the law.
Okay.
You know, there is something called Child Care Aware of Kansas and Child Care Aware of Missouri.
Child Care Aware?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Child Care Aware of Kansas, Child Care Aware of Missouri.
Those are websites?
Yes. And they offer a free referral system, only licensed providers.
Mm-hmm. And you recommend it?
Yes.
Eldon?
There is in Johnson County, we do have two. We do have the Family Conservancy, which Dean is from. We also have the Daycare Connection. But I certainly encourage parents to contact the resource and referral agencies to help them find. And I like your point that they work with KDHE. So only licensed providers are going to be given out to parents. And the parents should only use the resource and referral agencies, not go through online or whatever else, and then find that. And once they've gotten that connection, that list, once they've narrowed it down, that's when they go in the state website, and then that's where my staff can help out as well.
Bridget, do all states regulate child care to one degree or another?
Well, yes and no, and the regulations really vary by state. They're kind of all over the map. There's also no national standards really. There are some for centers that take children with some subsidies, and only very recently, in the last year or two, have they increased the standards for to actually have better safety. We haven't even gotten to quality yet, though. Yeah. So they really are all over the map.
Is there any connection with our conversation here today and the fact that this country has the highest infant mortality rate among developed nations, Dean? Is there a connection there?
Yes, obviously. Mm-hmm. It was mentioned before that we have no parental leave that's required by, there's no mandate for parental leave. There's no mandate for sick leave in this country. And I think there are only a couple countries in the whole world that don't have that mandate for maternity or paternity leave.
Okay. We're going to have to leave
go ahead, Bridget. It's Papua New Guinea, Tonga, yes. Suriname, and the United States. Those are the only countries without paid maternity leave.
Okay. We're going to have to leave our conversation there, but I appreciate you guys enlightening us on a lot of these things. I learned something. I didn't know some of these issues. Eldonna Chestnut is with Johnson County Department of Health and Environment. She's the Division Director of Child Care Licensing. Dean Olson is President and CEO of the Family Conservancy. Bridget Schulte is Director of the Better Life Lab and the Good Life Initiative at New America. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to a long-haul trucker in a world we don't know a whole lot about, I guarantee you. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we discussed trauma-sensitive schooling, and we met the two nuns behind Kansas City's Operation Breakthrough. You can hear those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date and on the NPR1 app. On Monday's program, Money, 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 the smart money experts discuss how President Trump's tweets affect the stock market. I guess they do. And they'll debunk some common money myths and separate fact from fiction.
He's pounding down, loaded up and trucking. Are we going to do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just like old Bandit Run.
If you've ever been curious about a trucker's life on the road, well, I have, and goodness knows we've got plenty of truckers traveling our highways here in the heartland. Finn Murphy has written a new and very engaging book about this world. It's called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road, and it's full of stories of the people he's moved and an inside look at what long-haul truckers go through every day. He makes pretty good money. As a mover, he's known by as a bed bugger, and he's not held in very high regard by his fellow truckers. And Finn Murphy takes great pride in packing his truck high and tight. Finn Murphy joins us now from Nantucket. And Finn, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
I'm well. And why are bed buggers not held in such high esteem, Finn?
Well, there's a couple of different reasons, Steve. One of them is we load and unload our own trucks, so we do a lot of work, a lot of different kind of work. So that's viewed with a little bit of suspicion. Another thing is we probably make a lot more money than your standard truck driver, so that makes a little bit of a difference too.
So how are you treated at truck stops when you show up then?
Well, see, we don't have regular routes because we go where the moves go. So we're sort of ghosts out there on the road. So we can't be relied on for that piece of pie and coffee at 10:30 every Tuesday. So that's what another thing that kind of sets us apart with gypsies, really. I mean, I never know where I'm going from, you know, one month to another.
What type of trucker is held in the highest esteem?
Well, it depends who's looking at him, isn't it, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
we like to think the movers are. Specialized, so it really depends. So specialized truckers, people that haul specialized materials, you know, you see those big wide loads.
Yeah.
People that haul those expensive cars, like Ferraris taking them around the country, those guys always have nice trucks.
But amongst the trucking fraternity, is there a group that sort of the truckers sort of regard as the best people to hang with?
Yeah, so that would be the guys that hang out at the truck stop. That would be, you know, the freight hauler, the box haulers, because, you know, they constitute probably 80% of the truck drivers out there.
What's the biggest misconception that people have about truckers?
I think, you know, that we're not really a harmonized group of rednecks. We're actually, it's pretty diverse out there. Especially, you know, the last decade or so with mandatory drug testing, you see a lot of husband and wife teams out there now, a lot of people with pets. It's a lot more domesticated maybe than it looks from the outside.
That's interesting. You don't buy the idea that truckers are somehow these, you know, these modern day cowboys, which is often how they like to portray themselves. Why do you feel that way?
Because trucking is probably one of the most regulated industries in America, especially for the big freight haul companies now. You know, they've got 24/7 video cameras inside the cab. Your hours are electronically done. Your hours of service are electronically monitored. The truck is monitored. The speed is monitored. Your acceleration, your braking is monitored. This is not Wild West American freedom. In any way that I've been able to figure out.
Is it too much regulation, or given the history of trucking, is it justified?
Well, yeah. So all of the new regulations, and there's new ones coming in now with electronic logging devices, you know, they always say it's for safety, which it may or may not be for safety, but I personally think it's overregulated, yes.
But, well, the issue is you guys are supposed to drive so many hours a day, but typically truckers have always gone beyond that to make better money, and that's caused problems, hasn't it?
Yeah, so you have to separate the two kinds of truckers. You've got, you know, your owner-operators or your lease drivers who are paid by the mile, and then you've got your hourly drivers. So somebody, say, for FedEx or United Parcel Service or somebody driving for Walmart, those companies are going to run it strictly by the book, and those guys are being paid by the hour. They're going to keep their hours of service to the, you know, statutory 11 hours. But, you know, an owner-operator type of guy, he might stretch that a little bit if he's on a deadline, and that's what they're trying to eliminate.
I'm visiting with Finn Murphy. He's the author of a new book, The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. You work for a high-end moving company where moves can sometimes cost up to $60,000. What does a move like that entail?
So the moves like that entail that the movers do everything. So here's a perfect sort of a typical example. So last summer I'm moving a guy from Connecticut to Vancouver, Canada. He was a mining executive. And we went into the house in the morning with my crew of seven guys. He was there having breakfast with his family. He finished his coffee. Everybody from the family got up off the table. They got into the limo, and they all went to the airport. And then we cleaned up the breakfast dishes, and then we unmade the beds, and then we packed everything in cartons over the next 2 days. And then we loaded the truck, and then we drove it to Vancouver. And then we unloaded everything, made the guy's beds, put his crystal back into the brake front. He didn't do a thing.
Wow.
And
wow.
That's why we get the extra money.
Loading the truck for you is something of an art form, I noticed. You write that how well a truck is loaded is the acid test of a mover. I'm wondering why.
Oh, I love doing it. I really do. There's almost a zen-like experience in doing manual labor that has an intellectual component to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I need to do is I need to fill the truck as tightly as possible without damaging anything that I'm loading. And a lot of these people, as you say, as you said, I'm in a high-end moving thing. So a lot of these people have very valuable belongings. So I have to be careful. At the same time, I have to be efficient. And that's where you get a real sweet spot in work.
Who pays the claim if one gets filed against you for breaking something? This was interesting to me. I didn't realize this.
Yeah, so there's a three-tier claim system. So me as the driver, I have a $1,600 deductible, so I pay all the damage claims up to that. And then the van line will take up the residue after that, maybe up to about $10,000, and they'll pay that out of pocket. And then they'll have an umbrella insurance policy, say if the whole load gets destroyed or lost or there's a fire, then an insurance company does that. But the insurance company is the third guy in the row, and the driver's the first guy.
How often during the course of a year will you have to pay out that $1,600? Someone like you, Finn, who's been doing this for so many years.
I'll very rarely pay up to that amount. You know, 95% of your moving claims are well lower than that. You know, maybe we dented a lampshade, or maybe we bent a rake, or something like that. So there'll be small little things every now and then. I won't hit the big deductible very often.
When you pack the truck, what are you aiming to do, and why do you do it the way you do it? Because you have a very detailed system for how you pack that truck.
Yeah, so it's all about making sure that everything fits into the truck, because a lot of my customers have tons of stuff. I mean, some people have more than one trailer worth of stuff. I moved a guy a few weeks ago. He had two full trailers of household goods. That was 80,000 pounds. So that's 40 tons of personal belongings. It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Why does he have so much stuff? And why would you want to pay to move it?
He's an American. He can't stop buying things, Steve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you point out in the book, you're pretty clear about this, sentimental value of stuff is a graven image and a mug's game. The only beneficiary is the self-storage guy. What my customers need to know is that it's not the stuff, but the connection with people and family and friends that matter. Practically everyone I move gets this wrong. So you're saying people move too much stuff, but that's your bread and butter, Finn.
It's true, because it's true, and it's sort of unself-serving to say
yes,
that.
Yes, right.
But I'll even be more unself-serving, because people are always asking me, what's the best way to move? And I say the best way to move is to sell everything and pack a suitcase.
That's the way they used to do it back in the early 1900s, you say, yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely a better way to do it.
After all these years doing it, you can visualize how you're going to load a truck as you go through the house. Do I have that right?
Oh, yes, exactly. I've got every piece locked and loaded in my mind, and I know where it's going.
What goes up in the front of the truck, the things you load first?
Okay, stuff, rough stuff. We call it, in the trade, we've got all this jargon in the trucking business.
Yes.
We call it chowder. Chowder's big, hard-to-load stuff that takes up a lot of room. So your barbecue grill and your big wicker chairs and all your outdoor furniture, everything that's in the garage, all those skis that the kids have outgrown, that's all chowder. And I try to get rid of that first in the front of the truck.
And you wrap almost everything that you move, right? You wrap it up.
Everything. Everything. Even rakes and shovels and implements of destruction, it all gets wrapped now. For the kind of client I have, that's what they want, and that's what they get.
I'm wondering, Finn, what's changed in terms of what people own and what people take with them as they move from place to place? What have you noticed even in the course of your career?
Yeah, so first thing, houses have changed, and then since houses have changed, and then the furniture changes. So when I first started in 1980, there was a formal dining room. There was a formal living room. In the dining room, there was a break front with, you know, nice plates you got from your grandmother. And there was a silver chest with the silver service that was a wedding present. And then you had a den, which had books in it. And then so when that all changed, you know, gradually. But nowadays, you know, a typical American house is about 35% bigger than it was a generation ago.
Meaning there's more stuff in it.
You have more room. Since you have more room. Yeah, you have to fill it up. I mean, isn't that a corollary of anybody's life, regardless of their income levels or whatever. If you have whatever storage area you have, you will accumulate to fill that, and then in most cases overfill that.
You get a bird's eye view, you know, into people's lives when you pack them up, and I imagine that sometimes you come across stuff that maybe you're not supposed to see.
Yeah. Somebody asked me this the other day. They said, what is the one piece of furniture where you'll get the quickest and closest view about somebody's life?
That's a good question.
And my answer is, it's the master bedroom nightstand.
Because?
Because that's where a lot of intimate things go. And so here's my request for the people that I'm moving. And the other thing is very common in America is they have a gun safe under the bed.
Huh.
So my suggestion is to empty the nightstand drawer into the gun safe, and then put the guns that are in the gun safe, put that in the nightstand drawer, and then that'll be a really easier for me, because I don't mind moving guns, but I don't want to move some of that other stuff.
We have a phone call here from Gary from Overland Park on the Kansas side. Gary, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm looking at cars like Teslas, and I'm researching automated driving. And I wondered if you had any comments about the thoughts of automated driving, of trucks driving themselves, the possibility, or if you think it'll ever be even allowed by government. Thanks.
Is that coming, Finn, automated truck driving?
Sooner than we think.
Really?
Oh, yes. I don't know if anybody's seen that YouTube video with the truck called Otto, O-T-T-O. That's the one that was driving all around Nevada, and then it crossed over Hoover Dam. And the driver, or what used to be the driver, he's lying in the sleeper reading a magazine. And Otto, the computer, is running the truck. I think it's going to happen within the next 5 years.
That's going to put a lot of people out of work, isn't it?
2 million.
Wow. You begin this book with a pretty harrowing account of driving your rig up in the Rockies, and I should point out that you've got a very modern, up-to-date rig that you drive. You've been driving for a long time, but you were white-knuckling this thing during this particular trip. What makes you nervous?
Ice.
Yeah.
Ice on the downhill makes me nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Because that trailer wants to slide away from you in the back. And the older I get and the more experienced I get, the less I like to drive in ice and snow.
Yeah.
And that might be something for drivers to think about when they see a truck out there on the road, on the highway, especially, you know, in bad conditions. That driver is probably, if not terrified, he's very focused.
Because you were certainly focused in your description of your drive that day.
And I'm not ashamed to say I was actually terrified, too.
Given the fact that you were terrified, cars driving by big rigs, other drivers, how terrified should we be?
So American drivers, I think they're pretty courteous, and I think they're pretty good drivers. And I think we'd all be excellent and courteous drivers if, when we're actually driving, if that was the only thing that we were doing, rather than putting on makeup or fixing your coffee or disciplining the kids in the back seat. Or texting, or here's what I think is the most common non-driving activity that happens in a car when it's moving, is that people tend to be working on their relationships with the person in the passenger seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and there's a lot of life stuff getting worked out. You can tell from the body language, Steve.
And you watch that sometimes.
Well, here's something else to remember, folks. We can see everything you do in your cars. Because we're way up high.
And
everything.
You see some interesting things, I imagine.
Not as often as you might think.
Not as often?
No, not as often.
Yeah, okay. Well, there goes that line of questioning then. Yeah.
I did get flashed once down in Pinellas County, Florida, which was which was very gratifying.
You meet some very interesting people during the course of your work and the people that you move. Tell us about Mr. Big, the wealthy financier who wasn't much of a treat to work with.
Yeah, Mr. Big wouldn't even let us use the bathroom in this house. And this house, this was a house with 11 bathrooms.
Oh, you're kidding.
I don't know. I just think, I don't know why certain people feel like they need to denigrate working people.
Mm-hmm.
There's no percentage in it for them, especially since I'm the one who's carrying all the possessions that they value and treasure are in my hands. So, you know, you'd think it wouldn't be that hard to be nice, but some people are that way. most of the people I move are actually pretty pleasant. But it's a very difficult time for families, too, and for the people I'm moving.
They're stressed, and yeah, right, I get that. Can you pack up and fit 11, a house with 11 bathrooms, a house that big? Can you get all that stuff in your rig?
Yes, I can if I load it carefully and if I take a bunch of stuff apart.
Yeah.
I got to
yeah.
take all that IKEA furniture apart.
Ah, really?
Oh, those crazy Swedish psychopaths. How did they figure out how to put that stuff together?
There's also someone you worked with. Her name was Mrs. M. Great story. Tell us that story.
Oh, so yes, she was a very ill. She was very ill. She was in her late 70s. She had emphysema. She had diabetes, and she was living in Connecticut. And she could barely breathe in Connecticut. And when her husband died, she wanted to move back to New Mexico, and she wanted to move the next day. This wasn't something that was on the schedule board. So I had to load her entire house in one day. I had to rush everything to New Mexico, and she died on the way.
What happened when you reached your destination there?
So her husband had died, and he was an archaeologist, and the Native Americans there in that area of New Mexico were going to give him a warrior burial ceremony, which I didn't know this before, but that has to be done within 6 days of somebody dying.
Mm.
And that's why I had to rush to New Mexico. So my customer's wife died, and my customer had died, and so I was running with the urn to get it to New Mexico in time for that ceremony. And we made it in time, but I was blind, and they actually invited me to come along, which I went. But I was blindfolded for the last part, so I don't know where it happened.
Yeah, you were blindfolded. Why?
Because this was a very serious Native American ceremony, and non-Native Americans weren't supposed to know where it was. And I don't know where it was. I don't have any clue where it was.
That must have been kind of creepy, though, being blindfolded like that.
It was super creepy. And, you know, I was driving in this, you know, I was riding in this old pickup truck, and there didn't have any air conditioning, and the New Mexico wind was blowing, and the sand was blowing all around. I could barely breathe myself. But it was fascinating as well. It's not the kind of thing that happens every day to your regular trucker.
Well, what part of this country do you most enjoy driving through?
Oh, there's a couple things about that. One of the things that may be a little counterintuitive is I like to drive places where nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I love Interstate 80 in Nebraska. I love crossing, you know, the 881 miles of Texas on Interstate 10. Just because what some people think is boring, for me, it means that I can relax a little bit.
You also take a lot of pride in your ability to maneuver your 53-foot trailer down narrow streets and while backing up. And at one point, you say you have to be able to both back up blind side as well as driver side. What does that mean?
So driver side is if I'm looking in the mirror from, so I'm on the left side of the truck, I'm looking at the left mirror, and then if I'm backing my trailer so that the trailer is moving off to the left, it's much easier to back up that way because I can see the whole trailer. Blind side is doing it the other way.
Ah.
And being a mover, I routinely put the truck into places where trucks aren't designed to go, like suburban cul-de-sacs, you know, big estates.
And you say a mundane morning's backup into a residence for a mover will often require more skill, finesse, and guts than most freight haulers might call upon in a year. So there you go, right?
Yeah, that's kind of an obnoxious statement, Steve, but I'll stand by that.
Finn Murphy is the author of the new book, The Long Haul, Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. Finn, stay safe out there. Thanks for taking some time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Steve. You take care.
On movie screens everywhere, the latest superhero sensation wields a sword, a shield, and a magical golden lasso. The only thing missing from Wonder Woman's arsenal might just be a pair of roller skates. Wait, what? Commentator Victor Wishna explains in this latest edition of A Fan's Notes.
If you believe the blockbuster numbers or the nonstop ads, this is the summer of the warrior princess. Wonder Woman, the movie, has come to save the day, riding a wave of good vibes and critical acclaim to the top spot 2 weeks running, and proving that, on a battlefield or at the box office, women can kick ass too. But if you want to see the real thing, that is, in the flesh, with no camera tricks or CGI, then head down to Memorial Hall in KCK this Saturday night when the Roller Warriors, Kansas City's premier all-female flat-track roller derby league, will once again take to the track. On teams with names like the Knockouts and the Black Eye Susans, women warriors of ranging ages and daytime occupations fight under alter egos that are simply wonderful in their own right. Little Miss Rampage, Gloria Strikem, Georgia O'Grief, and Yoko... Oh, no, you didn't. No bullet-deflecting bracelets or steel stiletto boots, just elbow and knee pads, and, of course, roller skates. Each squad deploys 5 skaters at a time, 4 blockers and 1 jammer, whose job is to push through the opposing team's scrum. So it's a little like rugby or football, you know, on wheels. The sport has its own Hollywood roots. Originated by a struggling film publicist, roller derby began in the 1930s as a series of endurance races, but its promoters realized the occasional collisions were the most exciting part and tweaked the model to maximize physical contact between the skaters, including elbowing, arm whipping, and slamming each other into the rink's outer rail. Teams were formed, the tracks got smaller, and the derby that emerged was far less Kentucky and more demolition. Speed mattered, but not so much as toughness, tenacity, and brute force. Contests were no longer billed as races, but as bouts. After World War II, roller derby's popularity soared. The league spread from East Coast to West, and in 1953, a new LA-based team made its debut at the Rose Bowl. Other teams played home bouts at Madison Square Garden, Comiskey Park, and the Oakland Coliseum, and many were televised. Yet by the early 70s, it was all over, shut down amid rising overhead and dwindling support. For the next 30 years, any effort to revive the sport met with limited and fleeting success. But then, early in the 21st century, roller derby started to make a comeback as a grassroots sports movement dominated by women, a new wave of leagues and teams owned and operated by the skaters themselves. In 2004, the Kansas City Roller Warriors were among the first few leagues to help establish the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, the sport's international governing body, which now oversees some 400 leagues worldwide. Men's leagues exist too, but the future of roller derby is female. This summer, the Roller Warriors launched another session of Junior Warriors, open to boys and girls, and it's mostly girls, as young as 8. As the league's mission statement attests, the goal is to foster a positive, hardworking sisterhood that empowers women and girls to be healthy, confident athletes, role models, leaders, and active contributors to our community both on and off the track. A proud tribe of Amazons, using their powers to make the world a better place. But enough of my mansplaining. Like any good athletes, these warriors let their game speak for itself.
Victor Wishna is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday, we're talking money with the smart money experts, and we'll talk about how President Trump's tweets influence stock prices. Yes, that happens. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. You're listening to it right now. We had help this week from Ron Yerman, Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.